It was raining cats and dogs this morning, and when I left the church building this morning, I had to run out. I was going to be the good husband and bring my wife's car. We took separate cars today, but we've worked things out. And so I was going to bring her van up to the front, to the portico, to, you know, show other people up. And so I run out there in the rain, concerned that, you know, I'm going to mess up my hair. And I hopped into the blue van and gonked my head on the frame of the door. The seat, somebody must have gotten into the vehicle and raised the seat. And so I hop in and, you know, hurt my head. And I don't remember a foam thing wrapped around the steering wheel. That wasn't there before. And I take my key and I put it in the ignition and it says, bad key. I'd gotten in the Carrillo's van. And so, you know, sometimes when you, you're following all the procedures and processes as best you know how, it's really easy to be confused as to why is this going wrong? I thought I did everything like I was supposed to do. And for the longest time in my own prayer life, that would be a good example of how oftentimes my prayers go, is that you feel like you're doing everything properly, but yet the end result doesn't work out exactly, it unexpectedly doesn't work out the way that you would want, and you can become discouraged as a result. Tonight, I'm going to share with you two stories and then make some applications. Those of you who grew up in the 70s and 80s, there were a lot of first responder type programs on TV. Some of you may remember things like Adam 12, Emergency Chips, other programs like that. And then in the probably in the 80s, it started getting a little more drama, you know, the lives of the first responders and those type of things. But from 1989 to 1996, there was a program on TV that was called Rescue 911, and it was hosted by William Shatner. And in the program Rescue 911, basically each week they would take people that had crises or emergencies, and they would play their 911 call and then talk about how difficult the situation was and how it worked out, and dramatization of those events. And one of the things that was interesting about that program is how useful it became in teaching children the importance of learning to call 911. And in fact, they started keeping track as people reported back in, you know, my child was in an emergency and they knew exactly what to do. And they started keeping track of, you know, we've had 100 lives saved because children are calling 911. And so this one particular episode involved a young boy named Jameson. And Jameson's parents were Michael and Peggy Rogers. And Michael, as the way the story begins, Michael is headed off to work, and Peggy, the mom, is going to stay at home with her two kids. Jameson is the older child. He is 3 years old. And they also have an infant daughter named Michelle, I believe it is. Yeah. And so Peggy has not been feeling well. And as a result, she had taken some antiseptic spray that you shoot in the back of your throat. You know how it kind of numbs everything back there for a sore throat? So she was taking that. And then she's kind of like me in that if a little bit of medicine is good, you might as well take more. And so in addition to doing this thing and numbing the back of her throat, she also popped in her mouth a cough drop. And so her daughter is laying on the floor, and she's over giving the daughter kisses on her belly, you know, doing the thing. And as she gets up, she inhales, and the cough drop gets lodged in her throat. And she's at home with a 3-year-old son and an infant daughter, and she's choking to death. And little 3-year-old Jameson figures out that mom is in trouble. And so he goes over to the counter and he gets the antiseptic, or whatever that stuff is, the spray, thinking that mommy needs her medicine. And he goes to give it to her. Mom is desperate. If you've ever been in a situation where you're choking, that's not your best moment. And she takes and throws the bottle away, and Jameson knows something's wrong. And Jameson goes into the bathroom. This is back before cell phones and those type of things, so you had the wall-mounted phones. Jameson goes into the bathroom, and just like he had seen on TV, he dials 911 as a three-year-old boy. And you can hear the recording of this three-year-old boy, and you know how these recordings go. In fact, I was going to mention it. Laura's brother, for a brief period of time there, worked as a 911 operator. And typically the recordings go something like this: 911, what's your emergency? And little three-year-old Jameson is responding. He says, "Mommy's not breathing." And the operator's trying to adjust to, okay, understand who I'm talking to here and the level of conversation that we're going to have. And the child is trying to explain what's going on, and the operator says, "Well, is your mom, you know, is she doing okay? Well, she, you know, she's laying on the floor and her eyes are closed, and she's sleeping, you know," because he doesn't know. And the operator figures out what the deal is, and I don't understand how the 911 technology has advanced since this time, but they are able to pinpoint that the call is coming from an apartment building. And so they've got very little time left, and the first responders are racing to get there. And they arrive, but this is like a 9-story apartment building. How are they going to figure out which apartment that this mother is struggling in? And so little Jameson goes to the front door of his apartment. He opens up the front door of his apartment, and he is looking for the first responders to come. And when he sees them, he waves them in, "Help, my mommy can't breathe." And it's remarkable that a child that age could do such a thing. He's a hero. In fact, in preparation for this lesson, I listened to a lot of calls like that. I listened to a 2-year-old girl on the phone with 911, and she's trying to explain that grandma can't breathe. It's just amazing. And somehow they had learned the process. They had learned that when you're in trouble, you call this number and somebody will help you. I mean, we do this at the school at Marquette. They bring in first responders and they introduce them to the kids so that they're comfortable and they are not scared and all those kind of things. And these children are able to understand the steps. They don't understand how everything works. They may not even understand what's wrong completely, but they know enough to call for help. And even a child as young as 3 or 2 is able to do that process. The Bible has a list of heroes for us in the book of Hebrews. You're familiar with this, Hebrews chapter 11. And it goes through a list of heroes that are on there, and it tells us a little bit about them. These are sometimes at chapter 11 is referred to as the Hall of Faith, or the Hall. These are people that amazing things happened in their life. The Bible uses the phrase to preface each of these things. It'll say, "By faith, the person did such and such," and it describes the various wins that these people experienced. It highlights the process to see God deliver the win is by faith. That's the process. And some examples of that include Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham and Sarah. And it's interesting, it talks about Sarah. By faith, Sarah has a baby, right? Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And we all know their stories. We learned their stories when we were kids in Sunday school. We know these stories. And the writer of Hebrews in chapter 11 is telling us, How did these people get deliverance? It was by faith. So they're communicating to you the process. And their stories are this. By faith, they worshiped God. By faith, they walked with God. By faith, they followed God's plan for deliverance. By faith, they saw God's promises to give them children when it's impossible. By faith, they saw their children and grandchildren learn to trust God and to pass that faith process down to the next generation. These are all things that we do, right? This is what we're trying to do. We're trying to learn how to worship God, to walk with God, to claim God for ourselves, to live in such a way that our kids have their appetite wet to follow God themselves, and then follow that process down in handing it from one generation to another. Laura and I are getting to the age now where we're seeing our kids take steps of faith themselves, and you're praying, God, please, you know, they're innocent. They don't know you're not supposed to ask for these things, right? Yet they have great confidence that God will provide. They don't know any better. They haven't learned to be cynical. Help them not to have their feelings hurt. And yet, you want God to deliver them. You want God to come through for them. You think about even in the situation of grandchildren or great-grandchildren like Joseph. And I was thinking the other day about the when Jacob is on his deathbed and he's talking to Joseph and he says, the archers have sorely wounded you. The pain that had to be in there. And Jacob had to feel a lot of responsibility because it was Jacob's parenting style that created a lot of that tension in that home. And so as a father, he's looking at a kid who is hurt in large part because of the poor parenting style that Jacob had, the tension that he created in the home. And as parents and grandparents, you want the best for your kids. You want to hand this down. And so the writer of the book of Hebrews is telling us that by faith, these people experienced that. They walked with God. They worshiped God. They saw God work not only in their lives, but in the lives of their kids and their grandkids. The passage then goes on later on to highlight some of the things that we think about in terms of big deals, in terms of faith. Right? We think about worshiping God, okay, by faith, Abel worshiped God. By faith, these different people did these things. And then it goes down to the bottom half of the chapter, and it pulls out some things that are probably not going to be experienced necessarily by us. Right? Most of us are not going to be standing in front of an ocean needing it to part. Right? That's probably not going to happen. Could, but probably not. Most of us probably are not going to find ourselves in a den alliance. Probably not. Could. Probably not. And so you have these unbelievably big moments that happen, and sometimes I think what we miss is the author is trying to connect is that the same faith that is powerful enough to open up oceans and the same faith that is powerful enough to bring down giants and to, you know, cause lions to have their mouth closed and dead family members to be raised from the dead is the same process that goes into raising your kids, to learning how to walk with God, to obeying Him, to see that faith passed on to one. It's the same thing. It's by faith. The whole thing is by faith. So whether you're standing in front of an ocean or whether or not you're having devotions with your kids, by faith. And that it's that process that we have to learn in the same way that 3-year-old kid, Jameson, learned the process. That when you're in trouble, you call these three numbers and somebody will be there to help you. He learned the process. And we make the concept of faith so mystical and so complex when it's not. It's not. In fact, Hebrews 11, verse 6 says this. It says, if I can find it here. It says, but without faith, it is impossible to please Him. For he that cometh to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of them that diligently seek Him. So from this verse, we are learning the process of faith. And we're learning what happens when we follow that process. First of all, the key, that faith is the key means to pleasing God. It explains in this verse that the person that comes to God for victory or deliverance must first of all, number one, believe that He is. This phrase, in my opinion, compares really well to when God is introducing Himself to Moses at the burning bush. And Moses is like, you know, who should I say sent me? And he says, I am. That you have to believe that God is. You have to believe, and by that, there's a couple things that go with that. Number one, you have to believe in His character. God has to be good enough to care about your problem. He's a good God. He's a loving God. Joshua and I were talking tonight there's a particular individual that I look up to and admire greatly. And their character is one of graciousness. That no matter who you are, if you come in contact with this person, they are going to be gracious to you. Not because you're such a wonderful person, but that's their character. They're just a gracious, kind, wonderful person. And we have to accept by faith that that is who God is. He is a gracious, kind, loving person. And that anybody who comes in contact with him is going to get that experience because that's who he is. He is a good God. He is a loving God. And so you have to believe that when you come to God with your problems, that he cares. He cares about your problems. Secondly, you have to believe in his capability. God has got to be big enough to handle your problem. We have been talking through in my Tuesday night Bible study about fear and faith. And the idea, we discussed this last week, or this past Tuesday, was the reason why people have fear when it comes to their problems is because the problem is big and God is not bigger than the problem. And that the way to overcome your fear is you need to magnify God. Part of the reason why we come to worship is because we want to gather on Sunday and Wednesday evenings and we want to magnify God. He's big. He's way bigger than anything you're going to encounter. Doesn't matter. Whatever it is you're going to encounter this week, God is big enough and God cares. So that when you leave here Monday through Friday or Monday through Saturday or whatever, whatever problem you come in contact with or faces you, God's bigger. He's bigger. And I think that the reason why we struggle so much with fear is because we haven't properly magnified God. That's one of the reasons why worship is so important for us. It's to see him as he is. And you look at the contrast and the difference between King Saul and David. King Saul is terrified of Goliath because Goliath is big. David is not terrified. Why? God's bigger. And that when God is big, it doesn't matter what you're facing. You're facing an ocean? Not a problem. God's bigger. You're facing lions? Not a problem. God's bigger. You're trying to pass your faith down to your kids? Not a problem. God's bigger. You just lost your job? Not a problem. God's bigger. Not only is he bigger, but he cares deeply about you because he's good. He's gracious. So you have to believe in his capability. He is a God of love and compassion, and he's inclined to use his power and resources to help. The second part of that verse, Hebrews 11:6, is that in order to see victory or deliverance, you have to believe that God is pleased to engage himself in your crises. So when little three-year-old Jameson picks up the phone and calls, he doesn't fully understand, you know, he barely understands what's going on with mom. He doesn't understand. He's just following the process. But on the other end of that line, there are people who we call first responders. You're not an interruption to them, right? What? Another crisis. This is what they do. They have trained for it. They love it. They want to make a difference. And so, by faith, you have to believe that you are not an imposition to God. Whatever is going on in your life, he's pleased that you bothered to come to him. Just bring it to me. In fact, he's anxiously looking at you. Whatever the situation, he already knows about your situation. Been waiting for your phone call. Looking forward to it because he wants to show you his love and his power. And so you're not going to be berated. The 911 call doesn't go like this. 911, what's your emergency? Yeah, I've got a fire. Did you start the fire? What could you have done differently to prevent this situation? Right? This is how we feel about our relationship with God. Well, if only I hadn't, if only. And we disqualify ourselves from God's help because, you know, we are partly responsible for this crisis. I should have been a little more smart when I was taking the cough drop. You know, I shouldn't have done the extra spray. And we disqualify ourselves as if somehow because you weren't smart enough or because somebody else did something that maybe God won't want to intervene. God is a first responder. He wants to respond. He's looking forward to the response, and he's not going to berate you about how you got in the mess. He's just happy you called. There's a commercial that I've seen recently for a company called ABC Plumbing. Their tagline is, "Consider it done." I do not like their commercials, but their commercials serve a purpose for this message. Their commercials typically show people asking, "Hey, did you get that leaky pipe taken care of?" "Yeah, I called ABC Plumbing." "Oh, great, so it's done." And the idea, and they go through several of these type of scenarios, and the idea behind it is you can be so confident if you place the call, it's as good as done, right? That's their marketing. Tonight, what each one of us should leave is with confidence that when you place the call to God, it's as good as done. That little boy, Jameson, makes the phone call for help. He doesn't fully understand the crisis. He just knows he needs help. And he was taught that if you call for help, help will come. And then he goes out waiting expectantly. "I'm over here. I'm over here." He actually expects help to come. He's a 3-year-old kid. I was listening to one of the recordings, the kid, I think, is 4 or 5. He doesn't know his address. And the dispatcher is guessing, like, "What school do you go to?" So she figures out what school district he's in. "And what color house do you have? What color is your front door?" He has to go check. "Are there numbers on the front of your house?" And he's, you know, he's not an expert. He barely knows his last name and where he lives, and he hardly knows the problem. And then when the first aid responders are coming, he sees them, and you can hear him in the background yelling, "I'm over here." He expects to be helped. He expects it. So tonight I'd like to look at, I told you, I promised you two stories. One is about Jameson, and the other one is from Daniel chapter 2. When we think of Daniel, most of the time when we think about Daniel being a man of faith, we think predominantly about Daniel in the lion's den, right? And I used to enjoy singing with my kids, you know, "Daniel was a man of prayer." And then you get to that part about the lions and you jump out and scare them. Sometimes you don't even sing about Daniel, you just jump out and scare them. But Daniel chapter 2 is, in my opinion, an often overlooked act of faith. And so I want to go through this passage with us as we take a look at this other life of Daniel and how it plays out with what we're talking about. Daniel chapter 2, verse 1 says this, "And in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams, wherein his spirit was troubled, and his sleep brake from him. Then the king commanded to call the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans for to show the king his dream. So they came and stood before the king. And the king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac, O king, live forever. Why don't you tell thy servants thy dream, and we will show thee the interpretation? And the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, The thing is gone from me. If you will not make known unto me the dream with the interpretation thereof, ye shall be cut in pieces, and your house shall be made dunghill." This did not go the way that the Chaldeans were expecting. This meeting took a severe turn in a wrong direction from their perspective. These are wise men, and if you're familiar with the story of Daniel, Daniel gets to Babylon, and the Bible talks about Nebuchadnezzar as the king. The reality is that Nebuchadnezzar was a co-king. He was a regent king for 2 years when Daniel's first there, and now we're into the second year of him being king alone. So he's a relatively new king. And we know enough about Nebuchadnezzar that he is an extremely volatile guy. I mean, remember the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace? He's a guy who can go off really quick. God is loving. Nebuchadnezzar is whatever the opposite of that is. He is a volatile guy, and he has a dream which causes him to be disturbed. The wise men, at this point, Daniel and the boys are junior wise men. Their sheepskin is barely wet. They're not even invited to this meeting. And Nebuchadnezzar says, I've had a dream. I want you to interpret it for me. And they say, great, just tell us what the dream is. We'll be happy to do that. And he says, no. I want you to tell me what I dreamed. And if you don't, I'm going to kill you and turn your houses into dunghill. They answered again and said, let the king tell his servant the dream, and we will show the interpretation of it. The king answered and said, I know of certainty that ye would gain time, because you see the thing is gone from me. But if ye will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you, for ye have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me till the time be changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can interpret. Show me the interpretation thereof. The Chaldeans answered before the king and said, there is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. Therefore, there is no king, lord, nor ruler that asks such a thing at any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. And it is a rare thing that the king requireth, and there is none other that can show it before king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with the flesh. All right, so this is completely unfair. You want us to tell you what you dreamed last night? And give you the interpretation. For this cause, verse 12, the king was angry and very furious, and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So this is now going to affect Daniel. Verse 13, and the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. So here, Daniel and the rest of the guys, they're not even at this meeting. And they're about to be killed. They don't even know it yet. And they're in a crisis. And it's getting really bad. So Daniel, as I mentioned before, Daniel is a junior wise man, probably just a wise guy. He runs into the head of the wise man's security, who has been tasked with carrying out a task that he was no doubt not looking forward to, which is to kill all the wise men. And so Daniel and the guys are in the dorm. And the head of security is coming through, and he's making it very clear, you guys need to come with me, you're going to be killed. And Daniel, what are we talking about here? And he gets the rundown of what has happened. And so he tells the head of security, take me to the king. And so Daniel goes into the king, and he asks for time. Give me enough time to give you an answer back. So presumably, because you can tell that Nebuchadnezzar is like on a hair trigger here, he doesn't get a week, right? You probably get a night. You got to have an answer for tomorrow. So Daniel's under pressure here to come up with something that has never been done before, right? Nobody's walking around telling people what they dreamed the night before. You might start off asking, you know, well, Nebuchadnezzar, what did you have for dinner? At least give me a clue. So he's got nothing. He's got nothing. Verse 17, then Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions. Verse 18, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So they go back to the dorm room and they lay it out. Here's what the deal is. If we don't have an answer tomorrow, we're dead. And I need you guys to pray with me. We've got a 911 emergency here. We need help. I don't know about you, but if you've got your death, impending death coming the next day, that's going to probably affect your sleep. I struggle when I have a flight out in the morning. I'm always worried that I'm going to oversleep. So you can imagine the pressure that is on. If tomorrow, if you don't have a solution, you're dead, that's going to affect your sleep, unless you're Daniel. So verse 18 says, so by faith, Daniel and his friends asked God to reveal to them what the king dreamed and also what that dream meant. And then they considered it done. Daniel went to bed in his onesie, as I like to say. By faith, he went to sleep by faith. If God does not deliver him, he will be killed. And that is certainly something that could keep you up at night. But Daniel has faith and confidence in God, because he called the first responder, and he let the first responder know that he needed help. Verse 19, then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. Years ago, I had a crisis in my life. And the crisis took place in the middle of the night. Someone that I cared about and was concerned for was in trouble. And there was distance and miles between us, and I was not able to be there to fix it. And even if I was, I wasn't smart enough to fix it. And even if I had enough money, I couldn't hire the right people to fix it. I wasn't rich enough, smart enough, whatever enough. And when you're in a moment like that, when you are completely convinced that you do not have any capability of solving this, the only thing you can do is call 911. And so I remember praying in my bed. I said, Lord, you told me that you wanted me to cast my cares on you because you care about me. And so that's what I'm doing. I'm giving you this problem. It's yours. And by faith, I rolled over and went to sleep because I was confident that somebody who was bigger than me, who loved me more than anything, could handle the problem. And I went to sleep by faith. I use the same process that the Bible describes in Hebrew 11. The same process that Daniel used by faith. I called 911 and I asked for help. It is unlikely that anyone here will find themselves needing an ocean or a river to part, or that you'll find yourself facing a giant or an army by yourself, or be surrounded by lions. But whatever your burden that you are facing tonight, by faith, you can give it to God. You can. Psalms 3:5 says this, I laid me down and slept. I awaked, for the Lord sustained me. Psalms 4:8, I will both lay me down in peace and sleep, for thou, Lord, only makest me dwell in safety. Proverbs 3:24, when thou liest down, thou shalt not be afraid. Yea, thou shalt lie down, and thy sleep shall be sweet. Psalms 121:3-4, he will not suffer thy foot to be moved. He that keepeth thee will not slumber. Behold, he that keepeth Israel shall not neither slumber nor sleep. I do want to make just one note here in thinking about that particular verse. We have members of our family, our body, that sleep does not come easy for them. It's not because they're anxious. It's because of physical issues. In fact, they would love sleep. And the message that I would have for you is that the Bible says that the one who watches over you does not slumber or sleep. There is not a night that you spend up that the Lord is not with you, that he does the watch with you, and that he cares about you. So even if for some reason sleep is not available to you because of the physical struggle, perhaps the cancer or other things that you deal with, the headaches, that God is with you, and he doesn't slumber. He's going to do the watch with you. Paul talked about the fact that the Lord was with me during the night. But you believe that by faith. You accept it by faith. 1 Peter 5:7 says this, casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. We opened our message tonight with the story of a 3-year-old boy named Jameson who did not fully understand everything, but he knew that he needed help. And so he believed what he had been taught, and he called for help. He called the ones that are in the rescue and delivery business. He called the first responders. And then he went and waited by faith at the front door, expecting that that deliverance would come. That 3-year-old boy is a hero, not because he knew how to do the Heimlich or whatever procedure was necessary to fix the problem. You see, the rescue team is looking for an opportunity to rescue. They're looking for an opportunity to make a difference. They're looking for an opportunity to show themselves strong in your life. And they're pleased to do so. God is looking for the opportunity to be your deliverer, to be my deliverer. And whatever problem that you are facing tonight, whatever it is that if I asked you, write down the one thing that if this thing changes, everything else is different. what would be the one problem that you're carrying right now? And the one who created you cares about that problem. And he's waiting. And it may be that he provides deliverance just like you expected he would. Or it may be that he comes and spends the night with you. But either way, it works. The process works. God is looking for the opportunity to be your deliverer, whatever the problem is. He's pleased when someone calls him and ask him to be their deliverer. Hebrews tells us that this pleases him. Pastor Potter this morning alluded to Jeremiah 33:3, which says, "Call unto me, and I will answer thee, and show thee great and mighty things which thou knowest not." Whatever your problem, don't take it to bed tonight with you. Instead, reach out to faith. Reach out to him by faith. He will be so pleased that you did, and you too. And tonight, you can give your burdens to God and go to sleep by faith, knowing that you have given the problem to the one person you can trust to handle it. Let's pray. Dear Lord, we thank you for the truth of this message and how even a three-year-old child is capable of believing a process for deliverance, and how we as believers often struggle. And we try to fix things ourselves. We carry anxiety that we should not have. We disqualify ourselves. We somehow blame ourselves for the crisis, or we think that it's not big enough for you to care about. But you care about all of our needs. And I ask, Lord, tonight that you would encourage each person here tonight to reflect on the fact that you're a big God who's bigger than any problem that they have, and you're a loving God who is pleased to deliver those that come to him. And I pray that you would help each one of us to cast all our cares upon you, confident that you care for us. We ask this in Christ's name.